Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Mark My Words here on the Life Coach Radio Network. I'm Mark Shaw, and today I'm going to interview a man with an amazingly inspiring story. I've talked about him in my workshops and classes, and now I get to bring him to life. But before we do that, I have an announcement that I'm delighted to make. You know that we've been experiencing amazing growth here at the Life Coach Radio Network. We're in our third month since the launch of the network on May 1st of this year. A few weeks ago, Blog Talk Radio was so delighted by our success that we are now a featured network on their homepage. What's more is that due to the overwhelming interest in our programs and the high demand on our schedule, with many people wanting to be a part of what we do here at Life Coach Radio Network, we've launched a second network. So I'm proud to announce our sister network, International Life Coach Radio, was launched 2 weeks ago to meet this demand. This is going to allow us to provide two coaching-related programs per day instead of just the one that we've been able to provide for our listeners until now. Soon, we'll launch our website where we'll tie the two networks together under one roof so you can follow the schedule in one seamless interface and ensure that you won't miss your favorite and most valuable coaching shows. I'll be announcing that website launch as soon as it's complete. As usual, we're going to be taking your calls later on in the show. The number to call is 646-716-9397. And, of course, there's always the chat room where you can ask a question either publicly or send me a private message, and I will try to get to it as well. So I'm really, really excited to have my next guest on the show. I never thought when I met Jason Littman about 14 years ago in a chat room online that we would end up in a long-lasting friendship that has inspired me as much as it has him. Upon meeting Jason, I instantly became a mentor to him. He was living at home with his parents in an ultra-Orthodox Jewish household, with a rabbi for a dad and a traditional, faithful, Orthodox Jewish wife of a rabbi for a mom. The challenge? Jason was struggling with some deep feelings, feelings that resided deep within his soul, the very soul he worked all his life to keep pure and holy. Jason was recognizing that he was gay. These feelings were disruptive to him. They were unsettling, and they caused him a certain degree of fear and stress. He hadn't talked to anyone about these feelings yet, at least on any deep level, and along I came on this one late night in an online chat room, and Jason and I chatted for hours as he told me his life story to that point. At the end of our conversation, I realized that he had nobody else in his life to talk to about this stuff, and I felt a huge responsibility to stay connected with him now that he opened all of this up to me. So I felt like I was uniquely positioned and suited to be the support he needed at that time in his life. There was a reason the universe brought us together, a reason for him as well as for me. So I gave him my email address, my phone number, and I told him to please use it if he ever needed to talk again. While my intention was to help Jason discover more of who he is, the result was that I, too, learned a lot more about who I am, my values, my strengths, my gifts. It's been a really wonderful experience watching Jason grow. I've watched him grow from a young man who was fearful and grappling with his sexual identity, from struggling to figure out where his place was in the world and in the Orthodox Jewish community he loved so much and which was all he had known at the time. I watched him grow into a man who is so comfortable in his own identity that a few years ago he officially announced to me that he is now gayer than I am, which I never thought was possible, and neither have most of the people that are probably listening right now. The Times of Israel newspaper has dubbed him the king of gay Jewish nightlife in New York City. And Next magazine here in New York City has called him Hebrew Homo Master of Ceremonies of New York City. So tonight, in our first part of the program, I'm going to share parts of that journey with you, telling you more about the ripple effect that making a difference can have. I'll share with you how the difference one person makes in the life of another becomes a difference made for hundreds of others as that person pays it forward, raising many others' levels of happiness and joy, one person at a time. In the second part of our program, I'm then going to bring on the man behind the story, Mr. Jason Littman, and I'm going to interview him and give you all of the opportunity to call and ask questions that are on your mind. Perhaps you're struggling yourself. Perhaps you're a fellow life coach and you coach clients who are struggling. Maybe you're a volunteer with people in the GLBT community helping them in their struggles. Or maybe you have a friend or a family member who's gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender and needs some perspective. So whatever your motivation is for listening tonight, we welcome your questions. So my experience of Jason, by the way, is that he lights up a room, and I'm sure that he'll do the same with our online studio here at the Life Coach Radio Network and with whatever room you're listening from now. So here's the backstory. Basically, it was late one night, back in the days of dial-up modems and AOL as the leading online service. And I started chatting with Jason in an AOL chat room, and he revealed to me that he wasn't sure if he was gay, but he was wondering. He was chatting online, looking to connect somehow, some way with others who would understand him and help him figure himself out. We talked for, I don't know, like several hours, and as I said earlier, I felt a responsibility and a desire to continue to be there for him, since he had no one else in his life at that point to talk to about these things. So I gave him my phone number and my email address. And he was afraid to call me at first and only emailed me. And finally, when he did call, he would do so from his parents' fax line, and he would block the caller ID so there would be no way that I could possibly contact him and maybe blow his cover. We would talk about Judaism and sexuality, his fears, family acceptance, and all the things that come up when you're questioning your sexual identity. And since I too am Jewish and my grandparents were Orthodox, I understood his Orthodox background to a significant degree. I knew that although Jason was struggling to make a choice between his gay identity and his Jewish identity, ultimately he was not going to have to choose. I knew that having to choose was true for him at the time, yet I also knew that the truth was that he would integrate the two down the road when he was ready after some rather deep soul searching and some exploration. So Jason was actually afraid to meet me in person, and I was a stranger from a chat room. More worrisome, I was a gay guy, and I remember Jason telling me that part of why he was afraid to meet me in person was because of the stereotypes he'd been exposed to about gay men being predatory. And he was going to need some time to work through that before ever meeting me in person. So what I did was I invited him, finally, to Carnegie Hall to see the holiday concert I was performing in with the New York City Gay Men's Chorus. This was back, I believe it was December of 2000. That's a group, by the way, that I continue to sing with today. And I knew that if he saw the LGBT community in such a beautiful setting, displaying its talents and gifts in a famous concert hall with a sold-out crowd of 3,200 people, that would just knock the stereotypes out of the water for him, while also probably reinforcing some of the more harmless ones. But I digress. I also figured that he'd feel more comfortable meeting me in a public place. He thanked me for my invite, but he said he wasn't going to come. It was too big a leap for him. And then a few weeks later, he called me really excited to tell me that he bought a ticket, but he wasn't going to come. He wanted to take the step of purchasing the ticket, even though he was still afraid and didn't feel comfortable coming to the concert. So I continued to support him in thinking of attending. And then by the time the concert arrived, he had decided to go. And during the whole concert, I remember I was on stage totally distracted, just wondering if he'd made it, and wondering what he might be thinking. Was he enjoying it? Was he terrified? And all I could think about was this guy who I hadn't even met yet and what was going on for him in the audience, and hoping that he was even there. So after the show, I looked for him in the lobby while I was greeting my friends and family, which, you know, we all do after our performances. And I see who I realized must be him. A tall, good-looking, dark-haired young man. And his energy of, what am I doing here? Holy crap, this is amazing, just radiated from him, and it was really easy for me to pick him out. I worked my way over to him through the crowd. I approached him, and I said, "You must be Jason." And he said, "I am." And he reached out for a handshake. Well, anybody who knows me knows I don't do handshakes. I do hugs. So I gave him a hug instead, which made his entire body stiffen up because he was just so uncomfortable. And we talked for a few minutes, and I invited him to the after party that we were having down the street at a restaurant, and he declined politely. He told me also to ignore the message that he left me on my voicemail a few minutes before the show that said that he'd made it to the concert hall but decided to go home. And after a few minutes, we said goodnight, and I went back to talk with my friends and my family. So upon heading to the after party, I saw Jason was still standing outside the concert hall, and I invited him again. And again, he said no thank you. So I said goodnight, and I couldn't wait to hear from him again and hear about his experience of the concert that evening. And since I had no way of calling him, I knew I was just going to have to wait. So later that night, I listened to the voicemail message that he left me that he had told me to ignore, And in it, he explained that he had made it to the concert hall, but when he saw a drag queen, he got scared and decided to leave. And he went to a payphone to leave me that message, because this was before we all had cell phones. But apparently, after leaving that message, something inside him told him to stay. So he stayed. So I had to wait until about the middle of the following week till he called me again. I was dying the whole time. I just really needed to know what his experience was like. So I asked him, what do you think of the concert? You know, when he finally called me, I said, what do you think of the concert? Wow, he said. He said, I was really amazed. First of all, I didn't realize how many of you there were. I thought when you said you sang in a chorus that there would be about 25 of you. And then I see 200 of you on the stage, and it was incredible. And then secondly, he said that after I decided to stay, after getting scared by the drag queen, I figured I would go in a few minutes late so that it would be dark and nobody would notice me. That's what he told me. So, of course, he ends up sitting in the center of a row, having to cause a whole bunch of people to get up to let him to his seat, calling more attention to him than he probably hoped at the time. And then he fills in with, oh, and you guys sounded awesome, which, of course, I also felt good about. So I asked him what he'd learned, and I was really fascinated by his response. He said, I learned that you guys are a community. Like, you seem to take care of one another and aren't just interested in sex all the time. And it was that moment that I realized that the mission of the gay choral movement, which is an international movement and community, which was to build bridges between communities and break down barriers and stereotypes, etc., was being realized. For the next 14 years, I had the privilege of accompanying Jason on his journey. I took him to gay bars. I invited him to other gay events, like more chorus concerts. I witnessed and supported him as he came out at work, as he came out to friends, and then ultimately to his family. And I remember we used to go to gay bars and clubs, and he would be so quiet. I'd see him go from being this talkative, outgoing, and extroverted guy who was always so open with me to a quiet, anxious, nervous, and perhaps excited but afraid to show it boy who I couldn't reach. And I watched as he looked around curiously and nervously. He would just stare around the bar. And at one point, on the very first trek to a gay bar, he looked at all the guys and he said, these guys are all gay? And I said, yeah, why? And he said, well, I'm surprised because most of them look like they can kick my ass. So much for the sissy stereotype. One more stereotype down, I guess. I remember finally suggesting that he attend Shabbat services, the Sabbath services, at the Gay and Lesbian Synagogue here in New York. And his reply was, no way. Gay over here, Jewish over there. Never the two shall meet. So I knew that seeing Jason in a gay synagogue was probably something that would, if it was to happen, would happen many, many years later. So throughout his years of coming out, Jason actually became quite involved with the ex-gay movement, trying to change his sexual orientation through a number of religious and non-religious-based activities. What he learned, I remember him explaining this to me, what he learned through these experiences was that his sexual orientation is not something that he can change or will away or pray away, that it's part of who he is and that God made him that way. So ultimately, he began attending meetings for there's an LGBT employee association that most companies have, actually, and there was one of the large financial services firm that he worked for in New York City at the time. But he wouldn't wear a name tag or tell anybody what department he worked for, and they used to tease him about that. And a few years later, he ends up becoming, yes, the president of that organization, in charge of the Gay Pride Month's activities and in charge of the float that their group had in the Pride Parade down Fifth Avenue in New York. I can go on with more stories, but I'm actually going to let Jason fill in the details himself. So let me just say that here we are 14 years later, and here's what Jason is doing now. The man who insisted that his gay identity and his Jewish identity must remain separate in his life is now the founder of Hebro Productions, and he produces a series of major social events and dance parties for gay Jews in Manhattan, and partners with GLBT nonprofit organizations and contributes part of the proceeds to them. His first event ever, which I attended, was 7 years ago, and it was a gay Jewish Christmas Eve party. And it was called the Jubilee. spelled J-E-W-B-I-L-E-E. He had about 300 people show up that first year, much to the surprise of the bar's owner, who he had to convince to stay open because they don't get a crowd on Christmas Eve. They asked him to then do his party again there the following year, and he had the luxury of saying he needs a bigger place, and that wouldn't suffice. Last year, 1,100 people attended. I remember walking in, and I was amazed that this huge dance club was filled with gay Jews and their admirers, referred to lovingly as bagel chasers by Jason and his crew. Music thumping, there were people dancing, even go-go boys in blue and white G-strings with dreidels and Jewish stars on them. Chocolate Hanukkah gelt, those are the little chocolate gold coins you see around at Hanukkah in little bowls all over the bars. Glow sticks, tables from various community organizations that would receive some of the proceeds from the night. I mean, it was quite a production. It was high-end. It was produced just so professionally and beautifully, and I had a tear in my eye because I just couldn't believe what I saw, and I was so proud of him. So I'm running around looking for him, and there he is, the gay Jewish mayor of New York City, running around in charge with his two-way radio and his little earpiece in his ear, looking all official and like, oh, my God. And I approached him with a tear in my eye, and I said, I'm so damn proud of you right now, Jason. You have no idea. And his reply made me feel really fulfilled. He said, all of this is your fault. And I said, oh, really? Okay, well, I will happily take the blame for that, no problem. We hugged, and he excused himself to go tend to the party to make sure that it ran smoothly, which, of course, it did. So the thing that I love about the Hebrew parties is that they're not just parties. They're connected with social activism. Jason's Hebrew Productions includes a very heavy component of social activism in what it does. So Hebrew partners with other LGBT charities that benefit the community in different ways. And to date, Hebrew has raised almost $20,000 for the Anti-Violence Project, the Stonewall Foundation, the Trevor Project, and AIDS Walk New York. Many people have flown in from out of state, even from Israel, to attend Jason's Hebrew parties. Jason also now writes, can you tell I'm selling? Jason now writes for the Huffington Post's Gay Voices section on a regular basis, and he's appeared in various gay media and Jewish media, including receiving an impressive distinction in a prominent Jewish news source, which I'll share about later. So, like I said, you can just tell I just fell when I talked about him because I think the world of him, and I'm so excited that I get to have him here tonight. Anytime I talk of him, I might share an example of something, in seminars and classes. When I always share examples from my life, and so I often share, examples of personal transformation of people that I know, and I often will share about Jason, and my audiences and my students can certainly see it on my face. I never knew 14 years ago that Jason would be on the radio, my own show no less, talking about his experiences. But here we are. And I have to say, it's, like I said already 3 million times, it's an honor to have him here with us this evening. So, Jason Littman, welcome to Mark My Words.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's so great to have you here. It's so great. Just want to remind our listeners, the number to call in if you'd like to ask Jason a question or me a question is 646-716-9397. There's also a chat room. So you can go in the chat room as well, and I'll also try to get questions off there. So Jason, I love your overall core message. We talked about this, and it's envisioning light at the end of the tunnel no matter what, and remembering that during your biggest challenges, and how you've never really defined your success by the successes, but instead by how you reacted to your failures and your downtimes. So I love that. That's very, very inspiring. So I'd like to ask, just as you hear my introduction to you, actually, what comes to mind? How does it all feel for you as you look back on where you were, where you've come, and where you are?
I mean, it's somewhat nostalgic for me in a lot of ways. It's interesting hearing you come together with that full circle. I mean, there's not too many people that I could say I probably know for so long and who knew me in different stages of my journey, so you're on one of them. So it's interesting to hear, but it's also nice to hear.
Well, good. I'm glad. Yeah, it's funny. I've never really told you the story from my point of view. So it's really kind of neat. So what was growing up like for you as an Orthodox Jew?
I mean,
actually, it's a two-part question, actually. And did you know when you were very, very young that you were gay, or did that come later?
You know, to answer the first part of the question, you know, growing up, I think any kid, whatever environment he grows up in is normal to him. So even though I was growing up in an ultra-Orthodox environment, to me, that's just what normal was. In some ways, I kind of just assumed the whole world was, you know, growing up the same way I grew up, just because I realized that, you know, that's the surrounding I lived in. And it's even more interesting because I grew up in Manhattan, and, you know, everyone always looks at Manhattan as a melting pot for everything. But growing up as a religious Jew, it really just meant having structure and rules and definition. And, you know, we were on a different schedule than the rest of the city. But even with all the differences in being such a minority, even within the city, I just assumed that that was the normal and right way of growing up. I mean, we were very much part of a strong Orthodox community that existed within, you know, the city of Manhattan, but it felt normal to me. To answer the second part of your question, I wasn't one of those people who knew I was gay since I was 1 or 2 years old or 3 years old. You know, I probably fall more into that person who has felt maybe different than the other boys, you know, that were my age, but I never really connected that to the definition of being gay, just because it wasn't part of my reality or my life, or I didn't know anything of it. I would say probably more in high school when, you know, I was going through puberty, I was a little bit of a late bloomer. I think then is when I really felt the differences. But for me, it was also somewhat conflicting because I grew up in an environment where we didn't socialize with the opposite sex. So none of my friends were going out and dating girls, even, you know, behind the scenes and whatnot. So it wasn't until I was like a late teenager did I start to put together these feelings that I had to a construct of a gay, of being gay.
So you really didn't have the language or the experience at all to relate to really identify the ways in which you were feeling different.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I didn't have a definition for it. And, you know, even though I grew up in a religious setting, I think that's probably for many kids. I mean, granted, now television, you know, has those messages, you know, about LGBT characters now. But even back then when I was growing up in the 80s, you know, that wasn't the case. And then not only that, I also didn't really grow up in that environment with television. So because we were religious Jews, we didn't have all that much connection to television and movies. So even if there were characters, you know, that were portrayed as gay on television or film, it wouldn't have been something that I would have had contact with me.
Sure. So it was really insular. You had no contact with the outside world and any other value system or any other life experience than what you knew as an Orthodox Jew.
Yeah, I mean, you know, still living in Manhattan, you know, just by living there, you're kind of gaining. So it's not like, you know, we were in an insular community as it is. I mean, we were still in Manhattan, so there still was exposure. But, you know, it was controlled exposure. And, you know, I couldn't stop walking the streets. But even in the realm of my, you know, Orthodox Jewish school, there were certain areas of Manhattan we were not allowed to, you know, that were off limits for us. And, you know, as I got older, I realized why. You know, it was either the West Village or Chelsea or 42nd Street, you know, because those were areas that were more conducive to, you know, different types of lifestyles in the Orthodox community I was living in.
Right, sure. So when did you begin to discover that you were gay?
You know, I would say it was late in high school. And, you know, because I was so focused on my religious studies, and I never really, you know, connected to it. But, like, you know, I did have gay feelings, but I didn't identify them as, like, okay. I told myself I had feelings for other men, but I didn't translate that into being, okay, that means I'm gay. I just thought there was something wrong with me without knowing the connotation of it. Only after high school, when I went to Israel for 2 years to have further religious studies, you know, did I kind of already connect to those feelings that I was having, to just having feelings for other men, to knowing that I'm different, to this means that you're gay. So that's kind of when I would say I first came out to myself, when I was, you know, 18 and away from home in the community I was already living in, even though I was, you know, in, you know, Jewish yeshiva school in Jerusalem, you know, even having further learning of Jewish studies.
Sure. What do you remember, Jason, that night that we first chatted online? What do you remember about, you know, what you were feeling that evening when you decided to, you know, go into a chat room? Chat rooms were, you know, all the rage at that point. What were you feeling? What were you thinking about? What were you hoping to connect with?
Well, I'll tell you certainly what I didn't think. I did not think I would be talking to you on the phone 14 years later. you know, I mean, probably what I was thinking is that you were an anonymous person. I most likely gave you like a fake name. And it was just great to be able to talk to someone about, you know, these issues, even though you're some random person, you know, out there in cyberspace, you were still a person and we were having a real conversation. So that was, I could even say that I remember like finishing that and feeling like I've gotten something off my chest.
How did it feel when I gave you my phone number, my email address, and I said, feel free to use it and call me if you need to talk?
You know, it was actually somewhat bittersweet. I mean, it was great to have that, but then it also was scary because I was like, well, I can't actually use this. You know, I had this resource, but I was, you know, my family by that time had moved to Brooklyn, and I was in another insular Jewish community, you know, and living a very Orthodox Jewish life. And it was kind of, in some ways, it was great to be able to have that resource, but then it was also bad to the effect because I wasn't sure if I could actually, you know, use it.
What made you decide to finally use it?
You know what it was? I think it was probably because I was already starting to date women in the manner that a lot of young Orthodox Jewish guys do through a matchmaker. And I think I just had this overwhelming fear of going into the matchmaking process and meeting a woman and then getting engaged to her within 3 months, which would be very appropriate in the community I was in. And I felt that I had to talk about this more and, you know, discover it and explore it and not just push it to the side, because I was already doing that for a few years and I thought that it was just causing me grief.
So what made you decide to begin to face your sexuality when you did? Is it pretty much, I mean, I realize what you said what made you decide to use my phone number was, you know, the fears around the dating world and matchmaking. Was it that really kind of just pushed you into the whole realm of exploring who you are?
You know, I think a lot of it was circumstantial also at the time. I mean, you know, back then, you know, it was the late 90s and the internet had really boomed. And I really do believe that, you know, if the internet wasn't there, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to explore outside of the bubble that I was living in. But internet being what the internet is, it allows you to have a glimpse of any part of the world. And I think just by exploring on the internet, it just felt like a safe way to kind of start discovering these feelings and talking about it and reading up about it, but then even more so realizing that I wasn't alone in these feelings. So, you know, granted I met you in a chat room, but then I used to also read, you know, on the internet about other Orthodox Jews who were struggling with, you know, their gay feelings and so on and so forth. So it really allowed me the opportunity to kind of further explore it once, you know, I had the ways to do it, and the ways can seriously just be the computer.
Right, sure. So that's one of the things that, by the way, I think is so great about the internet, because I think there's so many people, particularly young people, that are coming out, that are cut off, they don't have resources, they don't live in New York or San Francisco or Chicago, so they don't really have any resources, you know, nearby. Which I know firsthand, I was a volunteer on the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender National Hotline. And so the internet has really just been incredible for helping to connect people to things that help them, particularly young folks who are coming out. So your experience certainly, you know, speaks to that. Can you tell us a little bit about that fateful night when you came to your first gay men's chorus concert?
Sure. I mean, you know, that night was a very interesting night because, you know, I had created in my head what I believed the gay world to be was going to be like. And going to that concert really broke through the barrier of the stereotype in many ways. And I remember going there, and it's just a concert. Even though it was a gay holiday concert with a gay chorus, it just it was just something I had never done before. And I remember just approaching Carnegie Hall with just so much fear in many, many ways. And I think I was probably most fearful of seeing someone there I knew. And you know, even though the chances of that would be so minimal, and then, you know, so many people would say to me now, like, oh, if they're there too, then why would you be afraid? But that never made me feel better or more comfortable of going to places where I might see someone where I wasn't totally comfortable with it myself. You know, and I remember it just being an experience. It was obviously a very overwhelming experience. I had never, done anything like that from a gay perspective. And it was, in some ways, it was a great start to, physically exploring the gay world in some ways, and seeing a concert that was, just a concert that just happened to have been at a gay chorus and drag queens too. So it was just a concert, it was a holiday concert. It was also my first time hearing Christmas songs in a choral way, or in any way for that matter. So it allowed me the opportunity to really enter a gay world in a very non-threatening, pretty quote unquote normal way.
I never realized until you just said it. Was that like really your first exposure to Christmas music?
Exactly.
Wow. In 14 years, that never occurred to me. So I'd like to ask you a little bit, and I know that this is a little challenging territory, but about your relationship with your family since having come out to them. I mean, I know they didn't react very positively. And so I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about that and where things are now with them.
Sure. I mean, when I first came out to my parents, it was really, really tough for them. I mean, it still is really tough for them, for the community that we live in. I remember the first thing my mother said to me is, how are you going to have children? And, my father, his first response to me was, there's no purpose in life as a gay man. And, it was really hard for them. I think, I don't think it was, even though it was such news to my parents, I can't imagine my parents had no idea. I do know that they did suspect before. I think what was shocking for my parents was the fact that I was actually coming out. Because I do believe my parents suspected that I was gay by that time. But, just being in an Orthodox community, these are the types of things that I think my parents just assumed that I would stay in the community and just marry a woman, and I would deal with that issue in any way I had to deal with it. And it was a rough time. And, we had there was a time when we didn't have a relationship after that, and we weren't talking, and there was no communication. But I also realized that, I was already thinking about these feelings for 6 or 7 years, and this was new to my parents, in many ways. And now they had to go through their own, processing of this proclamation that I just threw down their throat. So there was a period of time where there was no relationship there, and it was really sad, and it was really difficult. And, I'm very thankful that, in the past year, since my brothers and sisters all have had children since then, I think it was my siblings who really pushed my parents and I to kind of get back together in the same room and to start having a relationship again, because my siblings wanted me to have a relationship with their children. And, in order for that to happen, I had to come around. And in order for me to come around, my parents were going to have to be around, or we're going to have to be in the same room together. I think it's still really hard for my parents. I think, for any parent who envisions their child having a certain life and then it not going in that direction, I think it's really difficult. But I think for my parents also, it's it's the community that they live in that also makes it much harder, because, you know, anytime anyone chooses somewhat of a different direction, then it's just difficult, because it kind of breaks the insularity of the community when one person kind of, you know, leaves, you know, that community. In some ways, I did leave the community. So I think that's hard on them. It's probably even more than the fact that I came out as gay.
Yeah. Well, you know, what strikes me, Jason, as you talk about them, I mean, I remember how hard that was for you. And what strikes me as you talk about them is how understanding you are of their reactions, their responses, and how forgiving you are for how they responded and how difficult it was for them.
Well, I thank my therapist for that.
Okay. So that wasn't your own design, huh?
No, it wasn't my own design. I mean, I think it was also just maturity. I think also in my 20s, in my early 20s, shortly after, I was very immature, and I hated them, and I was so mad at them, and I wanted them to be, you know, I wanted them to react in the way I wanted to react. But, you know, as the years went by and I started, I guess, getting older and more mature, I kind of realized that that's not necessarily a reality. And, you know, my parents are good people, and, you know, they, you know, when I was born, they didn't raise me into the air and say, I cannot wait to have a bad relationship with my son. You know, I know it was circumstantial, and, you know, none of us planned for this, and I didn't even plan for coming out and whatnot. So that in itself was a shock to me. So.
Sure. Yeah, I remember a very good friend of mine in grad school when I was coming out, said to me when I was talking about coming out to my parents and how afraid I was, and I didn't know if they were going to respond well or not. And I remember him saying, you know what, Mark? I was 23 at the time. He says, you know what, Mark? It took you 23 years to accept you're being gay. Don't your parents deserve at least that long? And that was very profound for me. I remember saying, yeah, they do deserve it. I hope to God they don't need that long. But, yeah, they deserve at least that. It's not easy for parents. I just admire how you've come through that and how you speak of them. So that's just really very cool. I just want to take a pause for a second, since we're at about the halfway point, and we'll come back to our interview in just a moment. But just to talk very briefly about some upcoming shows that are happening on the Life Coach Radio Network, and soon to be International Life Coach Radio as well. We'll be announcing our sister station's shows as well. So first of all, my next show, which is going to be on August 18th at 9 p.m., The Art of Confrontation with leadership coach Tanya Ezekiel. Proactive confrontation is what Tanya talks about, and it's one of the most powerful communication skills you can ever learn to build and strengthen relationships. Learning how to confront somebody from the right place in the right way can make the most significant difference in any professional or personal relationship. So Tanya helps you turn difficult conversations into more successful and productive ones, and she's going to be sharing with us three of the most critical steps that you can start using right away to make yourself a great communicator. That's going to be very exciting. The next three shows we have coming up on the Life Coach Radio Network are on August 5th, which is tomorrow, at 9 p.m. Frank Talk. Time, your enemy or your friend? So that's Frank Talk with David Frank Gums. He's a life coach and a spiritual mentor. And basically he says that time is a storm in which we're all lost. And why are so many of us at war with it? In this episode, Frank's going to discuss the implications of time and how we can all have a more peaceful relationship with it. Followed on the next day of August 6th with Danielle Mercurio, the new You City Coach Chat. And the title of her show is What Other People Think of You is None of Your Business. She's going to be doing a special encore presentation of this topic and discuss the ways that our concern about other people's opinions of us hold us back and how we can lift those internal blocks to get us where we need to go. And then lastly, on the 8th at 7 p.m., Gaining Perspective with Andrea Ruckelman. Too often in life, we only see things one way, and you never know how often we wear our blinders until someone else paints a picture that we've never seen before. So Andrea is going to share how changing your perspective in difficult situations can make a world of difference in our personal and our business lives. And that kind of brings us back to actually what we're talking about with you, Jason, about changing your perspective. So where we left off about talking with your family, and you were talking about how your perspective changed with the help of your therapist, and you've really been able to get to a place of forgiving your folks and other family members. So I'd actually like to ask, how would you describe your relationship with your folks and brothers and sisters now?
With everyone in my family, it's a little bit different. You know, with my parents, we have a good relationship. I'm going home for the holidays. I'm seeing them for the holidays. I'm seeing the rest of the family for the holidays as well. And we have a good relationship. Do we talk about, you know, my gay life? Not really so much. But we're able to have conversations and be together in every other way. I think my parents are still, you know, working their way through it and trying to understand what it means to have an out gay son. You know, and kind of like you mentioned in the introduction, it's not that I'm just gay. I'm pretty out there. You know, I'm very visible in the community. I write publicly about it. So it's not just the fact that, you know, I'm gay and I have this, like, life that they can somewhat, you know, not totally focus on or recognize or talk about. It's, you know, they're dealing with someone who's also, you know, out there in the community in many ways. You know, with my siblings, I had different relationships with each one of my siblings. You know, they're all still part of the Orthodox community, but they're also a different generation than my parents. So they have, you know, different forms of wanting to, of being able to be a little bit more modernized and dealing with this and accepting this in a different way that my parents can. But then I also have some siblings who are struggling with it in their own ways, you know, trying to find a balance of, you know, being traditional and keeping their kids into an interior community and wanting to, you know, accept me and have me part of the family, but also kind of have somewhat of limitations of how far they can go with that. Then I have another sibling whose kids know I'm gay, who are very okay with it and who talk to me about it. And it's, you know, they're a little bit older and they already have friends whose fathers who have come out, or, you know, they have friends that they know of in school that, you know, are coming out, or, you know, they're seeing on television shows gay characters. They even though they're Orthodox, they have televisions in the home, so they're exposed to different sort of things. You know, right now I think the conversation with my family is how to, you know, what's the right age to tell, you know, my nieces and nephews, if there's a right age at all. It's still evolving. So even though it's been, you know, over 10 years since my family has known, it's still very much evolving, you know, the relationship in terms of the, you know, my gay identity. But I do know that, you know, now that there's grandkids involved from my parents' side, the focus is less on me and it's more on the next generation of kids, which I am certainly, you know, enjoying the fact that, you know, that's kind of where the family is. You know, when I first came out, it was the big thing in the family. But, you know, since then, with 8 grandchildren that my parents have and my siblings all being married and having lives, you know, my orientation isn't so much in the forefront of the family picture. So I actually enjoy that in many ways.
You enjoy not being the center of family source anymore, huh?
That's right, exactly.
Sure, absolutely. Wow. So, and I remember too, you know, that your concerns when you were first coming out didn't have like deep religious and spiritual conflicts around being gay as an Orthodox Jew. It was more about your community's acceptance. How did you ultimately resolve that? I mean, I remember you being in contact with certain folks, like you would write something, an article somewhere, and, you know, taking the risk that it might be seen and might be known that it was you. And then, you know, there were people from your community and people that you knew from a while back that kind of like, was that you? And as you started to kind of make yourself visible in the Jewish community as an out gay man. So how did you ultimately resolve that for yourself?
You know, I think that's the part, you know, even though I do feel like I've come to a point of resolution with that, it's also probably the point of, like, still sadness and longing for me because, you know, when I was part of the Orthodox community strongly, like, I really enjoyed it. I loved the sense of community. I loved the insularity. I loved, you know, the fact that, you know, my whole, like, timeline of life was defined for me in certain ways. Like, I would get married by 22, have a kid by 23, you know, move into a house, you know, by 25 and have more kids and just be part of a community. And, you know, kind of like as you mentioned, you know, coming out for me was not necessarily, I never had the conflict with God. You know, a lot of people are like, how did you reconcile, you know, your religious conviction and your orientation? I never had a problem with God. I never believed that God would have a problem with me being gay. For some reason that was, I just had such a close relationship with God that it didn't cross my mind that he would be upset if I was gay. It was, my fear was more from the Orthodox community. And, you know, when I made the decision to come out, I took down the label of Orthodoxy, but I still continued the relationship that I had with God, because that's really brought me a lot of comfort in a lot of ways. But I did miss the Orthodox community in many ways, and it took a really long time to find comfort in the fact that I'm not there. I wasn't one of those people that wanted to fight the Orthodox community necessarily to accept me, but I did look for other secular expressions of Judaism in my life, because I never had the problem with Judaism. I had the problem with the community not accepting me. And I've come to a place where I've found spaces within Judaism that are very accepting of who I am. And, you know, even as time goes on, I've found many within the Orthodox community that, you know, are welcoming too. And seeing that change and living through that change is quite amazing. But there is a part of me that still longs for, you know, the Orthodox community I had while growing up. And, you know, I in some ways feel more comfortable in Orthodox spaces than in other spaces that express different variations of Judaism, just because it's what I spent the first 20-some years of my life in. So, you know, I always kind of joke on Rosh Hashanah, you know, for the Jewish New Year, there's 2 days of the holiday, and I always go to the gay synagogue for one day, and then I go to an Orthodox synagogue for the second day here in Manhattan, you know, just so I can kind of connect to those parts of my identity that
Yeah. You know, I remember the first time I saw you at the gay synagogue, and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe Jason's actually here. And it's just, it's always great to see you there and run into you there. And I like that you divide your time. It's kind of like my parents always did on certain holidays, where it's like, you know, we divided our time between my mother's side of the family and my father's side of the family. So it's like two sides of your family almost.
Exactly.
What do you miss most about the connection to the Orthodox community that you once had?
You know, I think what I miss most about the connection to it is you know, in some ways the spirituality and the sense of connection and feeling a part of something. I mean, granted, you know, being part of the gay community, we have that too in some ways, but you know, I find that the gay community is very different than the Orthodox community I was part of. In the Orthodox community that I was part of, you know, we kind of all had the same way of thought. You know, we're kind of on the same timeline. And, you know, what we had in common was our Orthodoxy, which kind of encompassed every area of our life in some ways. But, you know, within the gay community, it's, you know, we're not necessarily, even though we're gay 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, being gay doesn't encompass every area of our life, like our careers and our decisions and, you know, so on and so forth. That might be part of it. And, you know, I miss that part of Orthodoxy where I can, where I felt that I was really much a part of something every day, every minute of the day. And, you know, the conflict that I have now in many ways as being a religious person in the gay world is that, you know, religion has persecuted the gay community for so many decades and centuries that, you know, there are many within the gay community that have, you know, issues with religion or God, because, you know, so much hurt has been thrown upon us in the name of religion or God. And it's a struggle for me because, you know, my religious connection and my connection to God made me who I am today in so many ways. And it's hard for me to sometimes express that within the gay community because I know so many people have a distaste of religion and God within our community. So, you know, what I always try to do is try to promote the fact that, you know, religion doesn't necessarily have to be God. You know, that's kind of what the Hebrew parties are all about. You know, religion can be a culture. Like, you can celebrate Jewish holidays and, you can have connections to your family, and that can be your, you know, your dotted line into religion. It doesn't necessarily have to be this evil force of, you know, contention and hurt.
Yeah, the numbers of people that are really, the numbers of gay people that are, that feel very, very excluded and hurt by the message they hear in religious communities is just enormous across all religions. So that's completely understandable. Tell me a little bit, shifting gears slightly, talk to me about your involvement with the ex-gay movement and what that was all about for you.
You know, at the time when I was, you know, really, really religious, it wasn't, I didn't have the option of seeing a gay affirmative therapist, a therapist who would help me with my gay feelings. You know, of course, I actually did have the option, but I didn't believe in the realm of, you know, the world that I was in, that I even wanted to do that. Like, you know, I truly believe that, you know, God had given me this test, and this test was these feelings towards other men, and that I had to overcome it. And that was my lot in life. And, you know, I remember it was the same way I found you, Mark, in a chat room. I found out about the ex-gay world through the internet. And I began exploring that, and I was in a very vulnerable place at the time. I was in my very early 20s, and I was just figuring out who I was. I had a little bit more independence, and I returned from Israel, from Jewish yeshiva, and I was trying to deal with this situation of my same-sex feelings. And I remember calling the Jewish ex-gay ministry that was around at the time, and I spoke to its director, and he kind of gave me the hope that I really wanted. You know, I really wanted to stay part of the Jewish community and the Orthodox community I was a part of, and, you know, I didn't want to go into that gay community. And that first conversation I had with him, he pretty much promised me that I can have all these things that I truly want, and that God didn't make people gay, and I have these feelings because of, you know, certain environmental situations I grew up with, and as long as I overcome those, you know, insecurities that I have about myself and my masculinity, I'll be able to have a fulfilling straight life. And, you know, it just seemed like it just seemed like gold, and it just seemed like an answer to my prayers. And that's what attracted me towards that.
Yeah. So you went through that experience, actually much more than I was aware of at the time. I was aware of what I think is the first such weekend that you had gone to. And I thought that was your only one until within the last 2 years or so, as I started reading your articles that you started writing for Huffington Post and other places, that's when I realized, wow, your involvement with that movement was much bigger than I had known at the time. How come you never shared with me the depth and breadth of your involvement with it at that time?
You know, I had very compartmentalized, you know, ways of living at that time. In order for me to survive in the situation I was in, you know, I was talking to you, to what degree I don't remember, but I was also exploring the ex-gay world. And I was probably, when we first met, I was actually probably more involved in the ex-gay world and just starting to have talked to you. I probably did more ex-gay stuff than non-ex-gay, than gay stuff. And in some ways, that just seemed to coincide with the Orthodox Jewish values I had at the time. So it didn't seem scary. Like, going to Carnegie Hall seemed so scary, but going to an ex-gay retreat, it seemed like the right thing to do to kind of overcome these gay feelings through a religious environment. And I think it was a survival technique. You know, I had this, you know, my Hebrew name is Mendy. And I remember, like, there was the Mendy part of me, and then there was the Jason part of me. And, you know, when I was Jason, I was gay. And when I was Mendy, I was, you know, Orthodox Jew, going to stay in that life. And when I was Jason, I kind of had this alter ego that was exploring, you know, gay life as well, for you, actually. And I think I had that that survival technique actually helped me, you know, get through many things. And, you know, the folks in the ex-gay world knew I was, you know, had a hand dipped into the gay world, but I never wanted you to know that I was exploring the ex-gay world, because I was afraid of what, you know, of what you would think. And I turned to you for guidance in the gay world, and that wasn't a subject I wanted to be challenged on, of why I was also involved in the ex-gay world at the time as well.
Yeah. That makes total sense. I mean, you know, as gay people, when we're coming out, I think we get very, very good at living two lives at the same time. And
at least two lives.
Very yeah, at least, exactly. You know, and it's so that makes complete and total sense to me. In fact, I mean, I'm sure you remember my reaction when you did tell me the one weekend that you were going to, and you had put me down as an emergency contact, you know, on the form that you had to fill out to go on the weekend. And I remember, I remember saying to you, you know that I never give you advice. You know that I never tell you what I think you should do, but I'm making an exception to that rule right now, and I'm telling you I think this is really, really a bad idea. I think you're going to find it confusing and harmful, and if I could tell you not to do it, I would. I can't because, you know, you need it's your journey, but I want you to know that I support you, and I love you, and I'm here for you, and I wish you wouldn't do this. And, yes, you can put me down as an emergency contact, you know. So I think I probably made myself pretty clear at that time. Like, okay, so if I explore this anymore, I can't tell Mark about it. So, that was – I remember being very concerned about the negative effect that kind of experience would have on you. How do you feel about it now, ultimately? What's your relationship to the whole notion of being able to have what looked like that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow that you were promised there?
You know, what I realize in the ex-gay world is that there is no actual change. You know, I mean, I was in it for 5 years, and, you know, I do believe that there are many people that, you know, are going to value their, you know, religious orientation over their sexual orientation and are going to, you know, do everything that they can to live the life that they want to. And if that means marrying a woman, that's what it means for them. And, you know, while I don't necessarily think that's the right way to go about it, I also am realistic that many people do that even today. But the ex-gay world, you know, what they promise to people is they promise hope. But even when it gets down to it, is someone's orientation doesn't specifically change, but they learn how to cope and move on with their life despite their gay feelings. But that doesn't necessarily lead to a life of happiness. You know, I have friends who continued on the ex-gay journey and who have gotten married, and, you know, they're dealing with their own struggles in life, you know, whether their wives knew or don't know. And, you know, I kind of see it in similar ways to my own journey. I came out, and I have my own struggles, too, just because I came out. But I do believe that I'm living my life more authentically and with integrity and, you know, along the way, which I don't believe that many folks in the ex-gay world can say for themselves. And I see the pain that they're going in because I understand the conflict. And I really do believe that the person who comes out as gay, especially from a religious environment, it's truly, truly a brave person, and it's a really hard thing to do. And that's how I see, you know, other folks that are out and gay and have come from a religious background. You know, and I have a lot of sadness for those who didn't have the confidence or the bravery to do that themselves, because, you know, I see them living in lives that are can be very painful.
Sure. For those of you who are interested in calling in, by the way, and asking Jason a question or me a question, the number to call is 646-716-9397. That's 646-716-9397. So tell me a little bit about the movie Trembling Before God. The movie, just for the refreshing the memory of our listeners, a movie about gay Orthodox Jews. And you so impressed me with when you went to see that film and then you ended up meeting the director and everybody in the cast. It's just amazing to me. So do you think you just kind of briefly encapsulate what significance that movie experience had for you?
You know, interesting, that movie was I had very mixed feelings towards that movie because, you know, thankfully, you know, the internet was already around by that time. So I already had somewhat exposure to seeing what was out there about Orthodox Jews dealing with, you know, their gay feelings. But, you know, seeing that documentary really brought it to kind of like to life, you know, hearing people's experiences, ones that I was able to relate to in many ways. But it also scared me because it also, you know, I remember seeing many of the characters and not being able to relate to them in certain ways. And, you know, many of the characters in that movie were in silhouette, meaning they were like behind a curtain and you only saw their shadow. And I remember that had a very strong effect on me, you know, to the stance of like, okay, you know, these people are not out. So, you know, should I not be coming out? Why are they so afraid to show their faces? So I remember I had many, you know, mixed feelings about that, even though that some of those people didn't want to show their faces simply for the fact that they were married to women and dealing with their, you know, sexual orientation or, you know, didn't have the confidence to appear in public. So there's a lot of mixed feelings going through my head. You know, in some ways I was relating to the characters, and in some ways, you know, I was like, I don't see myself in these characters at all, to relate to them. So, I came in and out of it with mixed feelings, which I'm assuming is exactly what the director of the film wanted.
Yeah, sure. So, tell me a little bit about the role that our relationship has played for you. I know we've touched upon it throughout the broadcast tonight in various bits and pieces, but can you just kind of pull that together for us a little bit? What role has that played for you, in your words?
You know, I would say the role our relationship had is really the patience. Like, you know, you always listen, you know, and I think that's something out there that everybody needs, just someone who can listen. I mean, there were many times when I was able to tell that you so badly wanted to say what was on your mind, but you didn't, because you knew this was my journey and not yours. And I kind of had to get to the end of that tunnel. And, you know, I think in many ways you kind of must have seen that I was going in the right direction, even when you thought I was taking some wrong turns along the way. To be able to just kind of stay there and hold out. And for me, you were kind of just like an anchor. It was like you were the guy that kind of kept me involved, you know, in that, along that journey of me kind of exploring who I was. And, you know, I didn't feel alone in it a way, even the times for the month we were talking when I didn't even meet. And I think that's something that's very important for people out there. It's just that, you know, dealing with this type of thing is very lonely. And, you know, finding support is something that's so instrumental, and mentors or other people that can relate to you, even if you don't meet them. You know, you can have mentors that are, you know, online or in any session who don't even know your real name, you know. So
right.
I think in many ways, you know, I looked at you as someone who was able to kind of, you know, help me kind of move along that, because I kind of just knew you were there, even though we weren't in constant contact during those first few years while I was making that exploration.
Mm. Well, you know, like I said at the beginning of the broadcast, it was as transformational and wonderful for me as it's been for you. I just discovered so much more about myself, too, just in being there for you, and in, yes, like you said, really holding my tongue at many points, and just, you know, kind of letting you have your own journey. In fact, it's interesting. It's summed up by one of my students at IPEC recently, when we were talking about the importance of coaches, life coaches, you know, not giving advice and not giving opinions, but helping the person come to their own conclusions, and how important that is. And one of my students said, yeah, I heard this really great quote, and the quote is, who am I to interfere with your lesson? And I guess I went by that philosophy without ever really knowing the quote. You know, who am I to interfere with your lesson? It's not up to me to make sure that you don't have any bumps along the way, you know? And I think that's a really valuable lesson for us to learn when we're helping friends out with things, when we're raising our kids, and, you know, really when we're being any kind of a leader to anybody in our communities and even to ourselves. So I mean, I've said this to you before, but I'll say it publicly again. Just, you know, it's been just wonderful being there for you in that way. It's very heartwarming, Jason, for me to hear you say that. And it's just as much a gift to me as well. And I want you to know that.
Awesome.
So shifting gears a little bit again, tell me what it was that made you join the LGBT Employee Association at the financial firm that you worked at.
Yeah, I remember honestly it was, you know, it was I was working in the investment banking and the investment bank division of a major financial services corporation here in New York, and I remember, you know, during Pride Month in June, you know, there was a speech that was given by the CEO of the company, and it was a very inspiring talk. Like, I hadn't known anyone there or then at the time, and you know, he just spoke about the importance of being out at work. You know, and there was a few sentences he said that really touched me and that made me kind of take that next step in my own journey in many ways. And he pretty much said that in order for you to give 100% of yourself to your work, you need to give 100% of you. And if you're not out of the closet at work, if you don't feel comfortable being who you are, you're not going to be able to give me all you have in doing your job the best way you could. And, you know, it was his way of encouraging, you know, LGBT employees to come out of the closet at work and saying that this is a safe space and a safe environment and you'll be supported. And him saying, I want you guys to be out because if you're not who you really are, it's going to affect my bottom line. So even though he had, you know, ulterior motives, for wanting us to be out, it also came from a very, very sincere place. And he really believed that, you know, if someone at their desk was able to have a picture of their partner at their desk with them, then they're fully themselves and they're giving them their full selves, you know, to their work. And, you know, I was able to tell at that time that, you know, I spent a lot of time, you know, being afraid of what people were thinking of me at the office or wondering what would happen if people find out. And even in casual conversations and in the corporate office environment, it happens. And, you know, I remember there were times that I would step out when people would start talking about their weekends because I wouldn't want to talk about, you know, my gay weekend in some ways. So I remember first, after that point, I made a decision to come out and you know, in the office environment, but I didn't do it right away. First, I joined the LGBT employee networking group that was available, and that became like a safe space to come out with other gay people, even if they weren't my own division. But then I made a decision that I wanted a leadership position on that committee, and in order to do that, the company required you to, you know, tell your boss because you were going to be using some company time to fulfill those duties of being, you know, running the gay group. And I told my boss, and, you know, she didn't care. She was very supportive. She was very excited that I had come out to her and told her, and she allowed me she gave me her blessing in doing this extra work, taking on this extra workload, you know, within the company. And, you know, once I knew I had her support, it made it easier to tell other people that I was working with because I didn't have to worry about what the repercussions would be. You know, I also had the experience of coming out in the Orthodox Jewish community and knowing their reaction. So no other reaction that I could have, you know, encountered could have, you know, been worse than that in some ways. So it, in some ways it helped me a lot, you know. And, you know, as you know and as you told me many times, is, you know, it's not that you just come out one time and, you know, it's all of a sudden everyone knows. It's a constant journey coming out. It's always, you know, in some ways people are coming out 50, 60, 70, 80 times in life.
Sure. No, absolutely. I just remember being so enormously proud of you because you went fairly quickly from not wearing a name tag to being the president.
That's right.
How long a spread of time was that?
You know, I don't even know. You know, you know, in the beginning, I think it may have been like a year, I would say. I still say it was about a year, you know, before.
That's what I was
thinking,
yeah.
Because, like, I remember when I first joined the committee, I was just a member. You know, I was the events chair, and, you know, I didn't really have to do a lot of work then. But then once I became the chairperson of the committee, you know, I was having conversations with senior management and letting them know why diversity is important. And it was harder to hide that from, you know, my colleagues.
Sure, sure. Very cool. Another thing for me to be proud of, and as Jason well knows, everybody, whenever he would tell me about something else that he did that was just really awesome, I would once again cavil and tell him how impressed I am. And I mean, he probably rolls his eyes by now when I say that, you know, kind of like your kid does when you tell them how wonderful they are, and they kind of roll their eyes and go, "Oh, Mom, oh, Dad." I imagine, Jason, that's probably how you how you feel when I say that stuff to you. But it's just all completely true and from the heart. So as we kind of begin to wind down over the next 10 minutes or so, let's kind of fast forward to what you're doing now. And how awesome you are now, which is just 100,000 times more awesome than you were the day I first met you. So how did you start Hebrew and the Jubilee?
You know, when I started Hebrew back in 2007, the end of 2007, the last few days of it actually, it was Christmas Eve, you know, I just wanted to be, you know, Christmas Eve in New York, and I'm sure around the country and the world, you know, Jews are known for not having much to do, and there's the stereotype that, you know, we go out for Chinese food and have a movie. But, you know, being in my 20s, I kind of didn't want that. You know, I wanted to socialize with friends. And because so many of my friends were in town, I wanted to have a get-together, which is kind of like you mentioned the earlier part of the conversation, where I just approached the bar and asked them if I can come with a few friends. And it was 2007, and Facebook had, you know, climaxed at that point. And those friends invited their friends, and before I knew it, there was almost 300 people there, you know, at that first party. And then it made me realize, like, hey, there's something here. You know, it also had a lot to do with my own journey of, you know, finding a place in Judaism, you know, to be Jewish and gay in a very comfortable way. And I started realizing and meeting people either through my engagement at the employee networking group, at my firm where I was meeting gays, or going to, you know, beach vacations on Fire Island here and meeting gay Jews, and I learned that there are so many gay Jews that want to express their Jewish identity outside of the realm of, you know, the structural Jewish community. Like, they didn't want to express their Jewish identity in Jewish spaces like synagogues and Jewish community centers, but they still wanted to express their Jewish identity, you know, in a way that was in an environment that was comfortable for them. And you know, and that's exactly where I was in my life. Like, you know, I was wanting to be part of the Jewish community, but not in a religious way. And people started asking me to do other parties, you know, throughout the years, you know, throughout after that first one, which is why I started doing a gay Jewish high holiday party and a, you know, a gay Jewish Passover party and a party for Purim. And the whole idea of these parties was to recognize that, you know, we all have different identities, but our primary identity might be our gay identity, and our second identity might be our Jewish identity, but we still need to, you know, kind of express that part of ourselves. You know, I have so many Jewish friends who have come out of the closet and they never reconciled their Jewish identity with their gay identity, and in some ways they put their Jewish identity in the closet. And I always tell them, in order for you to be a fully healthy individual, you actually have to reconcile that part of you, because if you come out as gay but then put your Jewish identity and expression in a closet, you're still closeted in some ways, maybe not through your you know, gay identity, but through your Jewish identity. And I really felt that's what Hebrew was doing. It was moving from the I'm gay, it's a struggle, like, what am I going to do, to really celebrating those two parts of our identities. And that's kind of what I really wanted from Hebrew, and that's what I feel like I've succeeded in creating these parties where, you know, a lot of people, I always tell people, I don't do gay work in the Jewish community. I do Jewish parties in the gay community, because I feel like that's the environment we want to be in. That's the community we want to be in. But we also want to tap into that other part of ourselves, that Jewish part of ourselves, in order to be fully healthy individuals.
And it amazes me to hear you say this 14 years after you said, gay and Jewish, the two shall never meet. How does that occur for you?
You know, in some ways, you know, it occurs to me because I've been able to find other expressions of Judaism. Is that to say that, you know, you know, I feel fully reconciled and complete. In some ways, as I said in the earlier part of this conversation, I do miss a lot of, you know, parts of the Orthodox community. But, you know, I feel like I've also been able to get past a lot of that and find other ways to create community. And even through Hebrew, I was able to kind of somewhat create a community that I felt like I had within the Orthodox community. You know, maybe not with Orthodox people doing Orthodox things, but, you know, the whole point of Hebrew was to kind of create some sort of mirror community where I feel like I'm part of something. So yeah. It feels good to have been able to have gotten to that point of reconciliation.
Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, when I meet other gay Jews around New York and I ask them if they know you, every single one of them says yes. I think it's probably safe to say that you are the most known gay Jew in New York City.
Thanks.
Oh, sure. No, absolutely. And you know, it's really funny, too, when I've run into people who don't know you personally, but know you, they know your parties. And they're like, oh, yeah, I've gone to those. And it's like, oh, do you know Jason? They're like, no, I don't really know him. I just know the parties. And it's like, oh, my God. So now it's even extended beyond just people who are immediately part of Jason's circles. But it's like, you know, it expands way beyond that. And it's really amazing to me. How does it feel to be referred to as the king of gay Jewish nightlife by the Times of Israel? I mean, what is that like?
You know, it's really interesting. You know, because you know I spend so much time trying to reconcile you know my gay identity and my Jewish identity, and then, you know, the media does it in the headline, you know, so easily. You know, and it feels really good. You know, in some ways, you know, even though I say the Hebrew parties and whatnot is very focused on the gay community, when it's recognized by the Jewish community, it has a different, it has a special place. It has a different sensation of feeling because, you know, this is the community I so want to be part of. So the fact that they're recognizing it, you know, makes me feel good and a part of something that I really want to stay part of.
Well, good, because you deserve to be part of it, and everybody deserves to have you leading it the way that you are. And it's really awesome. And to everybody listening out there, if you have not yet had the opportunity to attend a Hebrew party, a Hebrew event, whether it's walking in the AIDS walk or any of the other social events and the parties, you really need to. It's great. And you don't have to be Jewish. You could be a bagel chaser, as Jason calls you. Yeah, I really urge you to go. They're just really awesome, and they're a lot of fun. And they're such a different atmosphere than the typical, you know, Saturday night gay dance club night. It's just a whole different energy, and it's really, really great. Speaking of being a leader, I want to brag a little bit for you about the amazing recognition that you received recently. And it's really cool because, you know, you received a lot of recognition in the gay press as an Orthodox Jew, which I think is probably the easier part than the other way around. But recently, you were recognized the other way around as a positively contributing member to the Jewish community as a gay man, particularly the recognition you received was from Jewish Week magazine as one of the top 36 people under the age of 36 who's made a significant contribution to the Jewish community. And again, they recognize that contribution as a gay man. So if you could talk about what that was like, but actually first, if you can tell us about the significance of the number 36, I think that would probably help some of our listeners that might not be aware of that. So if you could explain that, let's just tell us, what was that like for you?
Sure. So, I mean, the significance of the number 36, it's actually, you know, two times the number 18. 18 has a significant place in Judaism because in Judaism, every letter of the Hebrew alphabet connotates a number. So the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet is Aleph, and therefore that connotates to number one. So, you know, there's two letters in the Hebrew alphabet that brought together comes out to the word Chai, which means life. You know, and those two letters in the Hebrew alphabet that spell out the word life or chai are 18. So, you know, Jews a lot of times and when they give presents or charity, they always give it in denominations of 18 because it's kind of like a good luck number. So, you know, the Jewish week today, I guess a list of 18 Jews was not enough, so they did 36. So it still has meaning.
Like, and, I have an aunt, actually, who to this day sends me $18 on my birthday all the time. And I also have a little, it's funny, I have a little cup in my cupboard in my kitchen that has 18 cents in it that a fellow member of the Gay Men's Chorus, who's Jewish, gave me when I bought my home. And he said, here, here's the housewarming present. Put this up in your cupboard. It's a paper cup with 18 cents in it. So, yeah, it's a very, very significant number.
Until this day, I was always trying to figure out who I can talk to change that number to, like, 97. So, like, the gift can be, like, $97 because I've also gotten $18. And with, you know, the price fluctuation, I feel like that $18 just doesn't mean so much anymore. But, you know.
Absolutely. Inflation, you know.
Inflation, exactly.
So tell us about receiving that recognition and how that feels.
You know, so that recognition was probably the Times Division was great, you know, to be called the king of gay Jewish nightlife, but it was a secular newspaper. What was so special about the Jewish Week is that it has a very strong Orthodox audience, you know, an audience that, you know, would even in some ways include my own family. So to be recognized by a Jewish newspaper that leaned more to the conservative right, you know, even though I always looked at my parties and, you know, my involvement in the gay Jewish community as, you know, bringing the gay community together, the Jewish community was really recognizing me for, you know, bringing, you know, these gay Jews into the Jewish community, even though it was a different way. And, you know, what I loved most about that, you know, getting on that list really had, you know, a diverse number of people who came from all different Jewish backgrounds, from Orthodox backgrounds, from secular backgrounds, men, women, young people, older people. So it really crossed, you know, the entire, you know, divide of diversity. And, you know, I was honored as someone under 36. And even though I made that list literally by a few weeks, there was another honoree there in that list who was also gay. And he was also Orthodox, and he actually created the first, you know, they didn't call it a gay straight alliance, it was an Orthodox high school. And it felt so good to be on a list with another leader who was gay and who was actually changing the Orthodox community in other ways by getting his high school to let him have a gay straight alliance. And just to be recognized from the community that I came from meant so much to me because it made me feel part of something that I always wanted to be part of, and it helped me feel more part of it.
Very cool. Well, congratulations on that. That's just awesome. And the last sort of official question I want to ask you actually is about if you could talk a little bit for us about your tattoo. The article that you wrote in the Huffington Post about it was the most moving thing, and I encourage all the listeners to go ahead. I guess they go to HuffingtonPost.com and just search for you by name and see everything that you wrote. And it's just amazing and just so touching and so moving. And as many people out there may not know, and many do, it is actually generally not allowable for Jews to get tattoos. And you hear a lot about how, you know, you can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery if you have a tattoo. And you have a tattoo, and it was a very significant experience for you going to get it as well as just having it to begin with. So share a little bit about what made you decide to get it. Well, first of all, tell us about what the tattoo is, if you could just describe it, and tell us what it means to you.
Sure, just a slight correction. That piece actually didn't appear in the Huffington Post. It was Tablet Magazine, which is a leading online Jewish media outlet.
Oh, gotcha. Sorry about that.
Yes, no worries. So, you know, the tattoo is actually an acronym, and the acronym is actually the Siyata Dishmaya, which is actually Aramaic, which is a dialect of Hebrew. It's not a spoken language anymore. But the acronym is actually three Hebrew letters, Bet, Samach, and Dalet, which, you know, come out to be the Siyata Dishmaya. But the Siyata Dishmaya actually means with the help of heaven, with the help of God. So we used to have to write these three letters on every piece of paper growing up in my Orthodox day school, I mean, elementary, high school, even in Israel, kind of throughout. Those letters always had very strong meaning to me, and my connection to God always had strong meaning to me. And I got the tattoo because I got the tattoo specifically of those letters because those letters really connected to me to my past and to who I am. And I got it in the form of a tattoo because a tattoo really is a paradox within Judaism, especially within Orthodox Judaism, because in the Bible it says we're not allowed to scratch, you know, into ourselves, and you know the modern day meaning of that is not getting a tattoo. But what was going through my mind is that verse in the Old Testament is actually sandwiched in between the two verses that talk about, you know, homosexuality. And when I wanted to get the tattoo, I wanted the tattoo because the tattoo represents the paradox of the Old Testament, and so does being gay. And I wanted those three letters to kind of stay with me because I really wanted the connection from my past to my present. And in some ways, I wanted to take ownership over my body, you know, from God. You know, one of the reasons of not being able to get a tattoo is because our body doesn't belong to us. And, you know, our body doesn't belong to us, it belongs to God, so we're not allowed to kind of desecrate it. But then, and that's what it says in the Bible, but then it also says, you know, people who are gay should be stoned to death. So to me, right. I never understood these verses. Like, on one hand, it's saying that my body is so holy and I can't desecrate it by getting a tattoo, but then a few sentences later it says that I should be put to death if I'm gay. So is my body, you know, make up your mind. Is my body holy enough that it shouldn't be desecrated, or is it, are there times when it's not holy enough because you're gay where you can be stoned? So, you know, I kind of felt there was a whole paradox in those verses in Leviticus, and, you know, getting a tattoo, you know, to me was always a paradox, you know, because of my background in Judaism, but so was, you know, being gay. And I wanted that paradox visible on me. And I actually got that paradox on my arm and my bicep because that's the place where we used to have to put our tefillin, which are Jewish prayer objects. And the tattoo was specifically on my bicep because to me God represents strength, and the tattoo face is my heart because, you know, God is in my heart, you know. So even though it is a tattoo and it's paradox and it's a religious expression that's on it, it kind of really details a lot of my journey in coming out as gay from, you know, from an Orthodox Jewish background.
So you sat next to a rabbi recently on an airplane who challenged you on that, didn't you? What was that one?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was an airplane, and, you know, with flight delays, you know, we were stuck on a tarmac, and he noticed my tattoo, and, you know, it started the conversation. And, you know, he was an Orthodox rabbi, and, you know, I gave him the background story, and he was very interested, you know, in hearing, you know, about my journey. And what was, you know, his first question to me was, like, are you Jewish? And I said, yes. And, you know, he said, I noticed your tattoo, and, you know, it's very interesting because it's a very religious expression. And then I told him a little bit about my story, and, you know, it was a very interesting conversation because, you know, he said he's had many conversations about, you know, the wrongdoings of homosexuality, but he had never actually met a gay person, let alone one from an Orthodox background. So, you know, it just created this conversation. It's like, you know, someone can have their views about gay people, you know, all they want, but then as soon as they meet one, their views might change, and it challenges them. So I probably got just as much out of that conversation as he got out of it.
Kind of as a closing remark, what do you want my listeners to know? What's the message that you want everyone to know based on your experiences? What do you want to share? What's the enlightenment that you want to get out there?
You know, I think the message, I mean, I know for me all along, you know, during my journey, I had a lot of downs, you know. I mean, they always say it's up and down, but usually when you're in that down place, you feel like it's just always down. And for me, that would always help me get through, you know, that thing is that it's not going to always be this way, and you know, we're going to change, we're going to be in different environments, we're in different circumstances, and the journey does change, you know. I try to shy away from saying it's going to necessarily get better, because sometimes it gets worse before it gets better, which I found was definitely my case, but definitely finding, you know, the right support system and you know, of friends, of mentors, but also just taking care of yourself and going at your own pace. To me, you know, it took, you know, about 10 years, 12 years, 14 years for me to get to where I am. And I think if I would have done it too fast, or if I wouldn't have explored all my options, I probably wouldn't be in the place where I am now. So I really always just encourage people to just go at your own pace. You know, Mark, you're always so helpful in never telling me to don't do that, but do this. And I think people, you know, need to know that it's okay if they go at their own journey, and it's okay if they slip up or mess up or do something stupid, but then to kind of try to pick yourself up and go right back on that journey. And even if you don't know where the journey is going to take you, just go on it anyway.
That's great. That's such great. That's such great insight, Jason. And thank you. Thank you for that. And it's been a wonderful 14 years. I look forward to the next gazillion years that I'm going to know you. Having you in my life is just such a joy. And anybody that has you in their life knows that joy. It's just really, really fantastic. How can people get in touch with you if they would like to reach you?
Sure. The best way is to email me, jason@myhebro.com. That's jason@myhebro.com. That's myhebro.com. And, you know, all the articles that you mentioned are actually on my About Me site, which is about.me/Littman, L-I-T-T-M-A-N. It has a lot of the writings that you were talking about.
Oh, great. Great. Excellent. And I will also have that information posted on my website by tomorrow. So if folks want to find Jason's information, you can find that on my website at www.markshall.com. That's MarkShall.com, where you can then click on the Mark My Words radio show tab, and you'll see the announcement of my next show, plus the details about how to contact Jason and where to find his articles. So as we wrap, again, I just want to invite everybody to listen to my next show on the 18th, which is The Art of Confrontation with Leadership Coach Tanya Ezekiel. You've been listening to Mark My Words for the last hour and a half or so, where I've been interviewing the wonderful Mr. Jason Littman. Jason, thank you so very much for being on the show this evening and for opening up and, you know, getting us an up-close and personal look at the man behind the I don't know what to call it, the man behind the amazingness, I guess, is just what's coming to my mind right now. So thank you so much for being here, and it's really been a wonderful hour and a half, and as well as a wonderful 14 years.
Great. Thank you. I look forward to another 14 more.
Certainly, certainly, certainly. So thank you, everybody, for listening to Mark My Words here on the Life Coach Radio Network. I'm Mark Shaw. I look forward to seeing you all next week on the 18th. And if you have any feedback for us or you'd like to send us a message, you can go to blogtalkradio.com/Life Coach Radio Network. Right underneath our profile picture, you'll see a follow button. Once you follow that, you can then send us a message. If you want to give feedback to me directly or tell me what topics you'd like to hear, you can visit my website again at markshall.com and fill in the contact form and just let me know what you'd like for us to talk about. So thank you very much, everybody, for listening, and I hope you all have a wonderful evening.